This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Eric Norman. Hey, Eric.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So why don't you start by telling me about what Lispcast or purely functional TV is? Which of those is which?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Lispcast is really where I post articles and stuff. And I try to identify Lispcast with me.
Okay.
So I'm Lispcast.
Okay.
But it's also like this umbrella company for all the other stuff I do.
Gotcha.
And purelyfunctional.tv, it's courses and a mentoring program for teaching functional programming, including the Lispcast branded stuff. So I had this idea at one point, and I still want to pursue it. It's just too early right now to have other people make videos in other languages. And so it'll be like an empire of other courses and stuff.
Okay. So purelyfunctional.tv is mostly teaching Clojure stuff, yes? Is that true?
Yep. Right now, that's what it's got. Mm-hmm. So there's five longer courses, and I've just started an online mentoring program where it's about once a week I publish a shorter course, and I'm getting lots of great feedback from members that are requesting and asking questions. Mm-hmm. And so I can tune the courses much faster than I was doing before.
Are you familiar with Brennan Dunn?
Yeah.
He has some great writings on how to do those type of courses.
Okay, I should check those out. I'm familiar with his freelancing stuff.
Yep, at least I know he's doing a lot of them. I assume he's been writing also about how to do them, because that's definitely his style. I haven't seen it explicitly, I suppose. But you could even just watch what he's doing and model him would probably be a useful technique.
Yeah, for sure. I'm always on the lookout for other business tips and stuff.
Yeah. So purely functional TV, Lispcast, this is your main gig, or is this a side hustle?
At the moment, it's a side hustle.
Okay.
I am working on a step-by-step plan to get it to be a full-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be a ways away.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I've struggled with when it comes to having these side businesses that are related to teaching is you kind of need to keep doing the work in order to keep teaching the stuff, I think.
For sure.
You agree with that?
For sure. And it was actually a kind of a problem. A problem is a good word. But when I started Lispcast, I was working in Haskell. And so I wasn't too fresh from, you know, my day job. So I actually had to kind of work it back up to be able to teach the stuff. So
This is actually perfect. So you have Clojure and Haskell experience then?
Yep. I've worked in Haskell for over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, professionally.
Excellent. So I talk back and forth with Joe Ferris, who's our CTO here, and he is a big Haskell fan. I also like Haskell, although I have less experience there. I'm a pretty strong proponent of Clojure as well. Clojure excites Joe less because he is a huge believer in the Haskell type system. And the power of that and its ability to prevent bugs. How would you compare and contrast working in Clojure versus working in Haskell? Like, what do you miss when you're in one of them or the other?
That's a really good question. And I'm glad you didn't pit the two against each other, because they're both really great languages.
Mm-hmm.
They're very well designed. The thing that I miss when I'm in Clojure is the compiler, the Haskell compiler, forces you to be very systematic. You know, you always have to be thinking about, what type do I have? Is this the right type that I need right now? And you don't have that in Clojure. In Clojure, you can just play loose with the types and pass anything around, which sometimes feels very nice, because sometimes in Haskell, you'd make a mistake and you'd use the wrong type. And so you'd get you know, three or four function calls in and you realize, oh, this is wrong. I wish I could put a string here. Mm-hmm. And in Clojure, you can just do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually notice that quite a bit. I pair a lot in my day job, and I see that a lot where people are just not systematic enough with their thinking. And because that I think that's the main distinction is in Clojure, you can be loose, and sometimes that's really dangerous, but sometimes it's just what you need because the type would be more complicated than the code. That's I guess my main criticism of the Haskell type system is often to do what you need to do. Well, you need a lot of type. You need to express this really well, and you don't need to do that in Clojure. You can keep it in your head. Basically, there's a type, but it's just in your head. But then sometimes, a type is perfect, right? Having a discriminated union, right? Like a variant, like several cases, and each case has different data. I mean, that's perfect for a lot of problems. And in Clojure, you don't have it. You just use a hash map, and you deal with the sort of mismatch.
Yeah. It seems like there are certain things in Clojure, like prismatic schema, which is kind of like, it would be nice if we had types-ish on this data. Or core.typed, of course.
Yeah, and so, yeah, the schema is really interesting. We use it, and I like it. It's runtime, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's obviously a cost for checking that your data is correct. Mm-hmm. And so they even have a system for, like, turning it on during your tests and then turning it off at runtime.
Huh, okay.
Or, you know, in production.
Yep.
And I think that's interesting. I like that you can test stuff in schema that you can't build a type in Haskell for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have all full runtime information. So often you want to know, not only is this a string, but does it match a certain regex, for instance, which you can't do in the Haskell type system.
Do you feel like the Haskell type system lets you write fewer tests?
No. I mean, the simple answer is no, but I was trying to think of why. I guess because I normally don't write a bunch of tests for all the cases that I don't expect to ever happen.
Okay.
In Clojure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean like type. See, this is where it starts to get fuzzy, right? Because a Haskell person would just automatically call it a type error. Whereas in Clojure, it's not a type error. It's a data error. Like, it's the wrong data. You have the wrong input. And so you test your corner cases and everything, but then you don't test like, oh, what if someone passes in a Java util calendar? Like, right. You don't test that.
Yeah.
And you don't need to test that. And also, I even have an article about this. It's about nil punning, right? Mm-hmm. So with the nil punning, if your system is designed well, and I think Clojure is, the nils kind of work with the way everything else works. So the nils get threaded through everything and it's not a problem. Whereas, you know, in other languages, well, you do need a test. What if someone passes in a null, right, to your JavaScript, for instance? You need a test. So a well-designed language with certain kinds of punning and stuff like that, maybe you don't need so many unit tests.
So do you do like test-driven development then in either of those languages?
I do, yeah. I like TDD, yeah. I use a lot of generative tests, too, in both languages.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. For me, I also do TDD, and so I'm writing a lot of test code a lot of the time, and I would love... A lot of the times, I'm writing unit tests that feel a bit mechanical, and it makes me feel like, okay, there should be a way to have a computer do this for me.
For sure.
Which sort of feels like the type system in Haskell. It's like, this is kind of what I want, which is like, I want confidence that my code works. I want confidence that I haven't forgotten things.
Right.
I want to poke at it in certain ways and have it respond correctly. And so my hope is that like the type system is good enough or like can become good enough that one day I'll write almost no tests or write almost no unit tests and just write a lot of integration type acceptance tests.
Yeah, and I think I've said this before in other places, but that I think that typing, you know, static typing, strong typing is going to be the future. I just, in some ways, I feel like it's not there yet. There are things in Clojure that I do that I wish I could express in a type. And then you've also got this trade-off. You know, you're talking about wanting the type system to handle it. And you can often make a type that does exactly what you want. For instance, you could make a non-empty list, right? You know, if you try to take the first element of an empty list, that's an error in Haskell. So you could make a type that contains a list, but the constructor throws the error when you make it and it's empty, right? When you try, you pass it a list, and if it's empty, it throws the error. So it throws it when you construct it way back, like at the beginning. And so then you can be guaranteed later on that it's got elements in it. So you can do all these things. Like, I think we had a type in my the Haskell company I worked for that was an email address. It was a string, but it was wrapped up in this type. And when you constructed it, it did a regex on it to make sure it looked like an email address. And it also like lowercased it and everything, normalized it. So the problem, the trade-off is that you've got all of these types and, you know, could you have just gotten away with the unit test? Right. So you're writing the type is, you know, sometimes non-trivial to a amount of code, and the test is an amount of code too. So there's often a trade-off.
So the, so to you, it's not there yet. Like, it could be one day we have a type system that's good enough that you feel more confident without writing tests, but you don't have that confidence yet, or you feel like the trade-off is maybe not quite in that favor yet.
Well, okay. So it's way more complicated than that. You know, cause we're comparing Haskell and Clojure, and
not necessarily like considering just Haskell in isolation. Like, if I want to write fewer unit tests, can I just write Haskell and then have more confidence that my code works and thus move faster because I don't have to spend time writing those tests?
I think if you spent a lot of time, maybe, and this is the trade-off, maybe an equivalent amount of time getting your types exactly right, then yes, you could do that. And you would be dealing with all these little corner cases, right? Like empty string. Well, I don't want empty string in my type. I want to disallow that. So I'm going to have to make a new type for it. And, you know, for instance, if you went to something like Idris that has dependent types, you would be able to say that in the type, but you can't say that in a Haskell type. So then you have this like aggregation of more and more types, and they don't compose that well. So to have a non-empty string that only contains the character A, like only A's, right? Okay, so now that's two, that's like four new types, right? You have an empty string, you have the string, now you have a type that doesn't allow empty strings. You have a type that is only A's but maybe has empty strings, and then you need another one that's non-empty A's, right? So they don't compose too well, and you just, so you want to stick with just regular strings. You want to stick, and so then you still have to do your unit tests. So that those are the kinds of things that, you know, you get into when you're programming Haskell, like real world stuff. It's like, oh, I'd rather just deal with it at runtime, like check at runtime if it's empty.
Any other stuff that you notice you miss when you're using one or the other?
Well, when I was using Haskell, I really missed the number of Java libraries that are that were available in Clojure. There's a lot of Haskell libraries, but they're of varying quality. I mean, this, and also I should say this was like 3 years ago that I stopped working in Haskell, so I think a lot of stuff could change in 3 years, but no, for sure, I had a lot of trouble finding libraries that I needed.
Have you done much Ruby work?
Nope, never.
Okay, no Ruby.
Not even, what is the like Rails start or something, like just make a Rails app?
Yeah, Rails new.
Yeah, Rails new. See, I don't even know.
Gotcha. Is your day job Haskell now, or is it Clojure now, or?
Clojure.
Okay.
Yeah, we have Clojure on the back end, Clojure script on the front end.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah, how is that having the same in the front and the back?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's So the whole same, like, it's not really that. It's that it's a nice language on the front and a nice language on the back.
Yeah.
I mean, we do communicate like closure data structures between them, but that's not the big deal. Like, I know a lot of people talk about, oh, JavaScript on the front end, JavaScript on the back end. It's the same. And so you get some advantage there.
Right.
But, you know, you're still in JavaScript. I think that's the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything, well, let me say that. How do I say it? JavaScript is, there's a lot of great stuff in JavaScript, but it doesn't have a lot of the modern amenities you'd want from a language today.
Mm-hmm.
And just say it that way.
Sure. It's very diplomatic of you.
Yeah, thank you. I have to be. I have to be.
Small business owner trying to attract a bunch of people.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have the lawyers to fight all these lawsuits off for libel.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people turned away because someone makes a joke about a language and they're like, well, what's wrong with it? I program in that language.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the joke had a lot of complex nuances behind it, a lot of...
Totally.
But it just sounded like an insulting remark, so...
Definitely. And I'm trying to do more to, like, talk about the positive things that I like as opposed to, like, bash the things I don't like as much.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, another example is when I stopped at the Haskell job, which I learned a lot. Like, I'm going to quote myself, but I was really down on Haskell. I was really down on static typing.
Mm.
And it took me a while of talking to people who were into it. I mean, really, it was piecing apart. Is it Haskell? Is it typing? Is it the way we coded at the company? Because that was like my first real exposure to professional Haskell. Like, I started to piece apart, oh, that's not how other people do it. And, oh, that's not the only way you can do typing. And, you know, Haskell by itself is actually okay. And so it's like just trying to find the borders between what I knew of Haskell and what was possible in Haskell versus, you know, the realities of Haskell. You know, it's all there, all separated out now, so I feel good about Haskell again.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about Purely Functional TV.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, how is that going as a business? Is it growing at a rate that you're happy with?
Of course not. I mean, how could it be?
Uh-huh.
I mean, no, it's growing, and I'm on some kind of track. I'm not on the track I want to be. I would like it to grow faster.
Mm-hmm.
I just started this online mentoring program, and I'm moving from a sort of buy each course separately approach to an all-you-can-eat subscription model.
Mm-hmm.
And the real reason behind that was that it would take me months to get a course out.
Yep.
And during that time, I was not engaging with people, right? So
yeah,
it would just be like me making material and refining it and finding, you know, 2 hours here, 2 hours there to make some progress. And all that time, I had all this material that I just couldn't get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally said, you know, this isn't getting any faster. I got it down to like 3 months, but that's still a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not getting any faster. I would rather be able to make a 10-minute video, you know, even if it's imperfect, and get it in people's hands. They can watch it. They can ask questions. They can give me advice. And then I make another one. Mm-hmm. And it's another 10-minute video. And so one day I was hanging out with some friends and they said, you know, oh yeah, I'm really into these like subscription video things. And I thought about it and I said, I'm going to go home right now and try it out. I'm going to do one because I was in the middle of this like 3 or 4 month long video production process. I actually went home and did it. And 2 hours later, I had a 10-minute video and something that was, you know, good enough to release to the world versus 3 or 4 months of late nights and stuff. And then I have like an hour and a half of video.
Right.
And no feedback in between. Right?
Right, totally.
Yeah, once I realized that, I finished up that other video and I gave myself a little break and then I started it.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been running that?
1 month.
Okay.
So it's not even like a whole cycle of, you know, subscription and cancellation and all that. So I don't even know how well it's doing, really.
Mm-hmm.
Like how, I mean, I know I've gotten nothing but positive feedback, so that's good. I'm also very lucky. I have a lot of people who just want to see it exist, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So they're willing to fund it, even if they're not interested for themselves.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the closure educational resources market is very saturated, I would say.
No, there's plenty of room. So if anybody else is out there who wants to get in on this, I mean, I think now is the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you knew this, but the first video I did was a Kickstarter.
Yeah, I think I did see that one when you launched it.
Yeah, that was back in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And my initial idea was to do it for like $50,000 and quit my job.
Okay.
Do it full time. And it was going to be longer than it turned out to be. So it's going to be like 10 hours or something. And they would be released over the course of a year, and I would have that $50,000 to burn, right? But then my friend convinced me that's too big. Wouldn't you be satisfied if you could do like 2 hours for $3,000? And I said, yeah, I guess I would be.
Hmm.
And so, you know, he said, don't risk it because there's so many people who start a Kickstarter and it's too big and they don't have the audience or whatever.
Hmm.
So that's what I did. I did a $3,000 Kickstarter and for one video.
Interesting. But yeah, you think now is the time is why we're talking about.
Right. And when I did that, I was watching, you know, I also have the Closure Gazette. So I'm like, I have to have my fingers
in the pie?
No, not in the pie. But no, I have to keep a pulse. There we go.
Fingers on the pulse. There it is.
I have to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on.
Am I crazy?
Yeah, there's a thumb in the pie,
thumb
right?
Thumb in the pie? No, finger in a pie is definitely an idiom. Google agrees with me.
Yeah.
Anyway, keep
anyway,
going.
I started it at that time because I was like, it's now or never. Like, things are starting to grow. And of course, they take time to develop, so you have to be in on the stream before. But I started seeing like another newsletter come around and people publishing like free screencasts, and I'm like, okay, I got to do this before it's too late.
Do you have signs that the Closure world is growing?
You know, I did keep track of that for a little bit, but I've kind of lost the habit of it. So I don't have anything specific. So no, I don't really.
Yeah,
but I think it is.
Yeah, yeah, that's your sense.
That's my sense. I know that when I started this online mentoring program, you know, I wrote a sales page with copy and stuff. And in the copy, it's the point of the online mentoring program is to help programmers become Closure professionals. That's like the language I use.
Mm-hmm.
And once I put that page up and had like got people to sign up, so when they sign up for this mailing list, they get sent an email and the email asks a question.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working on? What obstacles are you dealing with? Where do you want to be in 12 months, right? So many people in that where do you want to be in 12 months say, I want to be a Closure professional.
Yeah.
I want to have a full-time Closure job, something like that.
Yep.
And there's just the number of emails I get on that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I must have like hit a nerve that people want, you know, they see the cool stuff in Closure. They see the functional programming. They see the immutable data structures. They see the concurrency. And they just want to, they want to do it.
Yep.
They believe in it.
It's interesting to me. So I see that happening in Closure too, and I think it's familiar to me because it looks just like what Ruby used to look like.
Huh, interesting.
Which is people were fleeing, or you know, people that were passionate about their tools were leaving other languages because they were inspired by Ruby and like how much they liked to use it. Only there weren't enough jobs for them to get. And so early on, there was more demand for the jobs than the jobs existed. And then eventually that shifted, like Rails kind of came along basically and then flipped that upside down. And suddenly there were enough jobs.
Huh, interesting. So Rails is what made the jobs? How did that happen?
I think it made the jobs because suddenly people were using Ruby in a professional way all of a sudden. It was like, hey, I think it kind of came down to how good Rails was. It was like, we can build web apps faster than before using this crazy language. It's called Ruby. Don't worry about it. There's this awesome framework called Rails. It's going to make us faster. And that was kind of the killer app for Ruby that changed that situation,
wow,
I think.
Really interesting. Like it was... all these startups were like, I can do this in a weekend on Rails.
Yeah, I mean, I think it straight up did improve development speed. And that's like, and right. If you can do that, then like, that's pretty huge. And so yeah. I think Clojure is kind of, it's in its pre-Rails phase right now. It's in the, it feels to me like a little bit like it's in the pre-killer app. I think actually the killer app for Clojure might be Clojure Script.
Yeah.
Like that might be what does it, is yeah. suddenly like the market is like, you know, 10x or 100x what it was before, because suddenly it compiles into JavaScript, which is a whole different ballgame.
Right. And it's really, I mean, I feel like it's leading the way in compiled to JavaScript languages and yep. like what's possible, that it's not just like CoffeeScript is great, but it's simply a syntactic transformation, right? It's
right.
not adding very much to the language semantically, but Clojure Script really is. And I don't know if you noticed, there was a video at ClojureConj this year that just came out, and it was talking about how you can do the module splitting. Mm. It's using the Google Clojure compiler. You can split modules just like automatically. You just say everything that this file needs and requires, put in this one. Everything that this file needs, put in this file. And then all the common stuff, put in this third file.
Mm.
And so you can split out your code that goes on like your home page that doesn't need all the like the stuff that runs your app. It's just the home page stuff.
Yep.
And then once they log in, they get this other JavaScript that has, you know, the meat of the application.
Uh-huh.
And so your home page will load really fast, and you know, there's no good way to do that in JavaScript. You have to do it manually.
Yeah, I mean, I think Clojure Script is an extremely compelling story for if you need a lot of JavaScript, then like just write this instead and life will be better.
Yeah, for sure. I've actually been waiting for, wow, a couple of years now, like that someone is going to go into one of these big popular hackathons,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, the ones that you where you make a website and everyone is like, wow, look at what they made.
Yeah.
That someone is going to go in with Clojure and Clojure Script and they're just going to rock it. Like, because their productivity will be so much higher and they'll be working in Ohm or some other React-based system, and they'll mm-hmm. be able to make something so much more interactive than people using straight-up JavaScript. I'm waiting for it to happen. It will.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the more compelling technology, and so you would expect to see this happen eventually or to see people migrating over there. And like the reason I think Rails did so well is because it was such a step up from where people were in terms of speed. So far, I don't get the sense that people are stepping up to the plate or like are like having quite the same experience in like Clojure/ClojureScript. It seems so far like it's just like another good option for developing systems, and like people seem to really like it. But I don't see quite as much people saying like this was like a step change over the past. Do you have that sense?
Huh, interesting. No, I don't have that sense either. I feel like it's still in the making, but we don't know what it would look like yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ohm Next is coming out soon,
mm-hmm.
and the promises of that are totally simplifying your application and the communication with the back end.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see that happen. I'm still not convinced. I feel like a lot of it, I mean, this is just me speaking with, just watching the talks and looking through the tutorial. I have no real experience with it. But it looks like a lot of it is just moving the complexity back to the back end.
Hmm.
So a lot of the like dispatch of, you know, where your data comes from is going to be on the back end. But it might be pluggable. So you can say, here's the Datomic back end piece. And it just works. And here's the Postgres piece, and it just works. It might be that simple.
Mm-hmm.
But because when you have these like large single page apps, you're doing a lot of dispatch on the front end, like this Ajax call and this Ajax call. And so all the logic is like in the front end.
Mm-hmm.
But if you move that to the back end and you just said, well, this is the data I need, the back end is going to find it for me.
Mm-hmm.
You are moving it to the back end, but It might be simpler than I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very bullish on Clojure and ClojureScript. Like, I think they have a really good future, and I think they're really compelling. But I feel like we still want that, like, there's a famous presentation where the creator of Rails demonstrated, you know, making a blog in 15 minutes or something like that.
Sure.
And I feel like there's not quite that for Clojure yet.
Well, yeah, I was really impressed when I saw that video, and I think it changed the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, you know, making a blog was like 4 weeks, you know, something like, it was like a week long project, and he did it in 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed the world. He made it like, this is what you should be able to do in 15 minutes. You mm-hmm. already know how it works. You just want to get started with it. I mean, but to be fair now, other systems have caught up with that.
Right.
I could write a blog in Clojure and ClojureScript in 15 minutes
mm-hmm.
without a lot of scaffolding. So I don't know if there's going to be another step change. Like, it's obviously not going to be write a blog in 2 minutes, right? Like, it's
right.
not going to be something yeah. like that where how fast can you write a blog? It's going to be something like, how fast can you write a scalable Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like that, where
mm-hmm.
like this actually took a lot of time to make Twitter scalable.
Yeah.
It could be something like that. Maybe it's something like, how long would it take you to write a game? You know?
Yeah, yeah. Or kind of like, the one way I could see it happening is like the shape of applications change. Like, maybe it's like this sort of like rich client thing, or hopefully not, or something along those lines, where it's like, look how fast we can make this new kind of thing, which is better than the old kind of thing. Like, you're right. I think we're not going to do the blog in 2 minutes, but like, maybe it's not a blog anymore. Maybe it's something else.
Right. Maybe it's like Google Docs in 10 minutes, mm-hmm. right? Like, where you have peer-to-peer communication and, you know, everything is synced up properly and there's no conflicts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah. So what haven't we covered that we should talk about?
I think we talked about everything I wanted to. The online mentoring program, I certainly want to plug that because
mm-hmm.
I still need more subscribers. The more the merrier.
Yeah. So do you have a URL for us?
Yeah. So I've been collecting notes here and there during our conversation. You can find it all at lispcast.com/giantrobots. That's one word, giant robots. And I'll have some goodies there.
Excellent.
You know, one thing I might want to talk about is teaching, technical
okay.
teaching.
Yeah.
So, you know, teaching is like what I'm doing now. And I've noticed that a lot of technical teaching is not really teaching. It's more just discourse, like talking about what you know.
Hmm.
And I guess the difference between teaching and just talking about what you know is that when you teach something, you don't expect the learner to have to do as much work, right? So I could talk about what I know. I make like a book, just write everything I know down.
Mm-hmm.
And then, boom, they have to go off and do a lot of self-study, like interpret what I said and like figure out what I meant and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But with teaching, the teacher does a lot more of that work, like breaking it down, making the exercises that the person just has to follow so that it's, you know, automatically learned just by doing the exercises.
Yeah.
Or, you know, good metaphors and visuals and stuff like that. So that's really the kind of stuff I'm trying to focus on. And I feel like it's one of the advantages that, like the competitive advantages that I've got is that I've got teaching experience.
Yep.
And I know how to make these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to get other people doing these things too. It's because mm-hmm. there's so much great stuff out there. There's so many smart people with all this knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be really cool if they could share it more easily.
Yeah, totally. So is your long-term dream some sort of platform then?
Yeah, that's really long-term. I try not to think about it too much because it's long-term. But no, it'd be great. I have a vision of like totally transforming education, but that's going to be different.
That would be a killer app for Clojure.
Yeah, right. Clojure is the answer.
If you transform education, then bam, you get some converts right there, I think.
I'm sure. I did it with Clojure. That's what I would say.
And there you go. Awesome.
I mean, maybe there's something like, you know, back to that other topic, you know, WhatsApp is done in Erlang.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of like a killer app for Erlang, is some kind of global communication system.
Yeah, but I feel like, I mean, so WhatsApp is probably going to inspire a handful, like some number of people to try out Erlang and maybe use it for their next whatever. But I feel like not a lot of people are writing WhatsApps, probably.
That's true.
Like Rails, you know, Rails was like, here's a thing that we all are going to do a heck of a lot of in the next decade, and it's going to be better than it was.
Huh, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that. I was thinking of it more like, you know, expensive problems and how do you solve them, but not super common problems.
Mm, yeah. Like if you could make a better Excel, for example, like Excel only like 10x better somehow and still usable by normal people, like that to me is the kind of thing that you're going to like change the world on a scale that Rails was doing.
Right, right. I mean, honestly, I think where Clojure really shines. So the last company I worked for, it was a totally new startup. It was in Clojure, and it was two programmers. And we were doing so much amazing stuff, like just the power we were wielding. So at one point, we were on Heroku. Mm-hmm. We had 40 workers controlled from my computer, scraping millions of websites, aggregating all the data, putting it into a database, and saving the pages in a search engine. And when you're scraping at that scale, you have to be careful not to take down the server you're scraping, right? Mm. so we learned that quickly. Mm-hmm. So it was like we were monitoring the number of 500 errors that we were getting from each server. And we could like lower down the how much we were hitting that and use those same workers on, you know, another website.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that was just two people.
Yeah.
And you couldn't do that in other languages.
Yeah. So that might be enough. Like if it is just more powerful and great to use and you can do these crazy things with small teams, like who cares if there's not a killer app or like something, who cares if it doesn't even get that popular really?
For sure.
Aside from libraries, like you need a certain amount, but like if it's just this great, awesome tool that only people that are clued in use, then like fine, you know, that's okay.
Yeah, and that's kind of, I mean, it's kind of where it's positioned now, actually, when mm-hmm. I think about it. Like, the barrier to entry on Clojure is pretty high. Mm. You know, people talk about the first run experience and how hard it is even to get set up to run your 1+1, you know, to try it out. And I wouldn't say it's done on purpose, but it's certainly not a priority to make that better.
Yeah, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see it change. I think I remember seeing like some sort of informal poll of people at the ClojureCon asking like how many of you are working professionally in Clojure, and that's been going up every year. And
that's nice.
That might be the best indicator, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that we're gonna see some of these like, you know, early startups get successful who have been using Clojure.
Yeah, yeah.
And who will talk about how Clojure was instrumental.
Right.
So
hopefully so. Yeah. And I think if there's a technology like Clojure where a lot of people that are very passionate about their tools and are strong developers are going to, eventually people will start doing things in Clojure to be able to recruit those people.
Yeah.
Like
for
you
sure.
Basically couldn't hire me to write Ruby at this point. Like I have a ton of Ruby experience and like there's almost no Ruby job where like you would entice me to go write Ruby, I think. But if you're like, you know, we got Clojure over here, like you could use some fun Clojure at this thing. It's like, so that's a whole different kind of compelling. And I think there are a number of people that are in a similar boat.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I've done a couple of rounds of hiring and there are so many people who are ready to work in Clojure, even willing to take like a little pay cut.
Yeah.
And there's just not enough jobs for them all. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting problem. There's probably some businesses in that problem right there.
Yeah. I actually watched a talk as kind of tangential, but I watched a talk that was someone at like a big insurance company. And the talk was about how to bring functional programming and formal methods into these larger enterprises that already have a stack and they're not going to invest in another language. And his approach was to go ask people the managers for the hardest problems.
Nice.
I like it. You just say, like, what is the thing, like the thorn in your side that you never thought you could get rid of, but you like some old, he actually got some old XML based system that it was like a rule engine, but everything was expressed in XML. And he just attacked it from all sides with F sharp. And, you know, he was generating C sharp with his F sharp. And, you know, he was having fun. Mm-hmm. He was using functional programming and he was doing something good for the company. They never thought they could get rid of it, but he was able to attack it with better tools.
Mm.
So I think there's a lot of room for closure in that kind of system.
Yeah, I like that tactic. Go after the hard stuff.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. You know, you always think, oh, get an easy win, get your foot in the door. No, mm-hmm. Go after the hardest thing because you've got the biggest, you know, the sharpest knife.
Yeah.
Just go after the hardest problem.
Yeah, prove the knife is sharp by doing the hard stuff.
Exactly.
I like it. Awesome.
The stuff they wouldn't give, they wouldn't care if you failed because, oh, well, you know, so sure. Many people have tried and failed already.
Cool. All right, that's a great place to stop, I think.
Cool.
Awesome. I appreciate you coming on. And it's been fun chatting with you.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun on this side too.
Cool. Let me know if you solve that closure problem for the world and we can all start working in closure full time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. On my spare time.
Yeah, just tweet about it and I'll retweet it once.
It's a concise language.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly. Awesome. You want to plug that URL before we go?
Sure thing. So if you want more information about Lispcast, purely functional TV, please go to lispcast.com/giantrobots, giant robots, one word. Get on the Closure Gazette, subscribe to that, get on the mailing lists. You'll see them there. And give me a shout out. Send me an email.
Awesome. Cool. Today's show is produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/172. Thanks for listening.